During the Old Testament times, one of the laws, or one of the areas of law, that was very, very, very important to the Israelites had to do with the Sabbath. One of the reasons for this was that the most frequently mentioned cause for the Babylonian exile was a failure of the Israelites to obey the Sabbath and the laws of the Sabbath. And so what happened was, after the Babylonian exile, gradually during the next several centuries, rabbis developed an entire body of laws to add to the laws that you found in the Bible, the Old Testament. The laws in the Old Testament are what you might call absolute. The law of the Sabbath was, you will keep the Sabbath and keep it holy, because on 6 days God worked and on the seventh day he rested. So you will rest on the seventh day. And there were some general kinds of things that would be understood, that were given in subsequent statements in the Old Testament about keeping the Sabbath day and not doing work on the Sabbath day. But there were a lot of these things were not really well developed during the period in which the Old Testament law was being developed. But by the New Testament time, you had this huge body of law saying what you could and could not do on the Sabbath. And one of the things that was always part of any kind of legal restrictions or legal actions or something like that had to do with the things that were more basic to human life than law. So an example that I gave before was an ox goes into a ditch versus a child falling into the ditch. The ox is necessary for food, and food is necessary for the continuation of human life. So even if it was on the Sabbath, it was okay to get your ox out of a ditch. Your child falling into a ditch, no, because the child would be okay. The child would still be there tomorrow, would still be fine, and you could pull the child out tomorrow. So you leave the child there overnight. That was the way in which the law worked. Well, as I say, there were various situations where the law was interpreted in a way that was what we would think of as flexible. For instance, marriage ceremonies in the Old Testament period, especially during the New Testament times, but even in the Old Testament period, marriage ceremonies were really big affairs. And the marriage feast was always followed the marriage itself. The marriage itself was very, what we might call, low-key, because the marriage itself, the couple married each other. You did not have an officiating priest or something like that, the way that we have ministers that officiate, or we have priests in the Roman Catholic or Orthodox churches that officiate, and these sorts of things. The couple, at the appointed time, in a rather ceremonious way, the couple just came together and went to their new home and spent their first night together. And actually, all of the wedding guests stayed in the living room and slept in the living room that night. The next day, the party began. And the party could continue for 3 days, 4 days, 7 days, even in elaborate situations, 8 days. And you see, Jesus went to one of these weddings, maybe not that went for 7 or 8 days, but he went to a wedding that lasted a good while, because you see it in John in the wedding feast at Cana of Galilee. And it went long enough that they ran out of wine until he changed some of the water to wine. Well, the wedding feast was something that if it continued during or after the Sabbath, it was ruled by the rabbis that it was okay, because marriage was given before the law was given. Marriage, according to the rabbis, dated back to the early chapters of Genesis, while the law only came beginning about Exodus 20. And so marriage was more fundamental to human existence than the law. And so it was okay if you violated the law of the Sabbath to celebrate a marriage, because that was even more fundamental. Well, I talked about David's going in and taking the bread off of the table of showbread, and the whole nature of the situation. And the interpretation about that generally is that, one, David was an anointed person of God, and therefore, in some sense, he was holy, because he was God's anointed man. And he was hungry. And it says he was hungry. And satisfying hunger is more basic to human existence than the law. So why did David not experience the condemnation for doing this? Because what he did was satisfying a need that was more basic than the law. Now, you don't have to agree with all this. I don't necessarily agree with it. But this was the way that these kinds of things could be interpreted. And what it does show is that even though the law was absolute, there are aspects of the law that may be flexible in character. So I just want to point that out to you, so that you have some sense of the comparison between an absolute law and God, who allows for circumstances in the application of that law at the human level. Okay, now, before we continue, let me ask, does anyone have any questions? In the New Testament period, the temple area had a sign, literally a fence, a rock fence that went all the way around it, and it had 13 entrances. And beside each entrance, there was a plaque. And on that plaque, it said, "Entrance beyond this point is for Jews only. And Gentiles who are caught inside the temple area, their blood will be on their own head." Now, that's not a perfect quote from what it said, but it's close to exactly what it said. We know these existed because they have found two of them in archaeological excavation around the Temple Mount. It's referred to in a kind of general way by Paul, but it's the specific ones have been found, two of them, in excavations around the Temple Mount. The idea was, if you are not Jewish and you go into the temple area, they're going to kill you. That's what it means. And now, they got to catch you first, but it's going to be pretty easy for them to catch you. There's a story in the book of Acts, actually, that is directly associated with this, because at one point when Paul is in Jerusalem, it's somewhere around Acts 20, when Paul is in Jerusalem, he is accused of taking, I think it was Titus, into the temple area where it was forbidden for a Gentile to enter. And this starts a riot on the Temple Mount. And the soldiers come down from the Antonia Fortress, which was right on the northwest corner of the Temple Mount. They come down and they grab Paul and kind of pull him up some steps to keep the crowd from basically killing Paul, because they were so angry at the accusation. Now, Paul didn't do that, but they were so angry at the accusation that Paul may have taken a non-Jew into the Temple Mount, they were ready to kill him. And this is actually the beginning of what ultimately leads to Paul's journey to Rome. But the Jewish people in the New Testament time period were very non-understanding when it came to anybody but Jews entering the temple area. Now, if you look at a picture of the Temple Mount, you'll see that the Temple Mount in New Testament times was a lot more than just the temple area. Down here, you had the area of the money changers, where Jesus threw over the tables of the money changers and so forth like that. Kind of in the center area here, you had the temple area. And the temple was located about right here. And there were lots of restrictions, actually, because there were meeting rooms or storerooms here. And this area was known as the court of the women. This is where women and men who were not completely normal and whole in every way, this is where they could go. This was the court of Israel, that is the men, and then right in this area was the court of the priests, which is where the altar of God and the sacrifices were done, and this was the actual temple itself. And going around all of this area was that barrier, that stone wall with the 13 gates forbidding entry into this section by anybody except Jews. Anybody could go anywhere else on the Temple Mount, but only Jews could enter within this court. Okay? And the Antonia Fortress was located kind of right here on the northwest corner. And that was a protective fortress both for the Temple Mount and for the city. Okay, did that help clear it up? Okay. Okay. Any other questions?
So basically, pagans, they when they converted to Judaism, then they had the right to go to the temple as well.
That's correct. If a person converted to Judaism, they had the right to go into the Temple Mount. Actually, one of the very interesting things to me, and I hope to you, is that in the New Testament time, the big issue between Jews and Christians was not whether Jesus was the Messiah. In fact, to this day, the biggest stumbling block between Jews and Christians is not whether Jesus was the Messiah. Some of you just said, huh? But it wasn't, and it's still not. You see, there were lots of messiahs that arose during the first and second century A.D. In 8 A.D., Judah the Galilean arose claiming to be a messiah, and a bunch of people followed him, and there was a mass crucifixion that the Romans staged to eliminate that threat. And along the roads of Judea and Galilee, there were 1,000 Jews that were crucified. And in crucifixion, of course, they're just put on the cross and left there to die, and then for the birds to come along and feast on the flesh and things like that. It's pretty gruesome. And the bodies might stay up on the crosses for months, and even after that, the crosses might be there for years, unless somebody actually comes out and takes the body down or removes the cross. Well, this happened in 8 AD, and another very well-known example is what is known as the Bar Kokhba Revolt, which occurred in 132 to 135 AD, in which the Jews in Judea, primarily in Judea, revolted against the Romans for a second time. And at the beginning of that revolt, one of the chief rabbis, Rabbi Akiva, actually declared Bar Kokhba, or he's popularly known as Bar Kokhba, to be the Messiah. And during the history of the Jews over the next 2,000 years, from time to time, here and there in Jewish communities, there has been a person who either the community recognized to be the Messiah or who claimed to be the Messiah. And these are not considered heretics. Wrong, but not heretics. As recently as the late 1990s, one of the most ultra-Orthodox Jewish sects that exists, the Lubavitcher sect, had concluded that their chief rabbi, Menachem Schneerson, was the Messiah. They actually arranged in Israel for a coronation meeting to name Menachem Schneerson the Messiah. And he went to the coronation. But to his credit, when he got up to speak just before they were going to proclaim him the Messiah, he told them, "No, don't do it. I do not have any confirmation that I am the Messiah. So you should not proclaim me the Messiah." And they didn't. But a lot of them were really, huh? Because they were convinced he was the Messiah. The idea of somebody arising in the Jewish midst to be the Messiah is not the main issue that split the Jews and the Christians. The main issue that split the Jews and the Christians in the first century, and the main issue that continues to keep Jews and Christians separate today, is that the Jewish world would accept people who were Christians if they would also commit to go through the Jewish initiation ceremony and obey all of the Jewish law and submit themselves to the authority of the rabbis. Well, what was happening was when a person became a Christian, they stepped out and away from the authority of the rabbis, because now they saw themselves as having a direct link to God rather than having to go through the rabbis and the law and the teaching of the rabbis and these sorts of things. And the non-Jews who became Christians, they didn't want to go through circumcision, which was one of the requirements to become Jewish. Not only that, but the teaching of the church was you get the same benefit of that faith brings through faith in Jesus Christ without having to become Jewish. You don't need to become Jewish. And so, whether Jew or Gentile, if a person became a believer in Jesus Christ, they no longer, if ever, were under the authority of the Jewish tradition. That was the issue between the Jews and the Christians. And fundamentally, it is still the issue between the Jews and the Christians. What are the most important ceremonies that we have in Christianity? We have church on Sunday. We celebrate Christmas. We celebrate Easter. Do you celebrate the Passover? Do you celebrate the Day of Atonement? Or the Feast of Tabernacles? Or Hanukkah? Or Yom Kippur? Do you worship God on the Jewish Sabbath? It starts on Friday night and goes till sundown Saturday night? You see, all of the religious traditions and activities that we follow as Christians are different from those followed by the Jews. Completely. There's no overlap whatsoever. Do you obey the law of kosher? The law of kosher says you will not eat pork in any form. No ham, no bacon, no pork. Nothing. You will not eat any kind of something from the sea except fish with scales. So that means no shrimp, no lobster, no oysters, no crab, and so forth. You will only eat certain kinds of birds. And so it goes. There's lots of details to the kosher law. If a person is truly Jewish and observant, they are going to obey the kosher law concerning food. What about you as a Christian? Are you going to obey it? Or in the Jewish family, a traditional Jewish family has four complete sets of tableware. Two are for every day, and two are for the 8 days of Passover. Why two? Because under Jewish law, you cannot mix meat and dairy. That means you can't drink yogurt and have bacon. You cannot drink yogurt and have any kind of meat. You cannot drink milk and eat beef. You cannot have any kind of dairy product, be it cheese. I mean, I love certain kinds of pizza with cheese. Italian sausage pizza, I love it. But a true observant Jew will never touch Italian sausage pizza, because you have meat, even if it's not pork sausage, you have meat and you have dairy. There is a law in the Old Testament that says you will not cook a kid, meaning a immature goat, in its mother's milk. And the rabbis, before the New Testament period, ruled that that meant that you could not have meat and dairy at the same meal. I think it has to be a half an hour separation between them. Well, if you are not willing to live by these kinds of rules and restrictions, and there's a whole bunch more, but these are enough, then you see, you do not embrace the Jewish faith, the Jewish way of life, or anything like that. And that is fundamentally what separates Christians from Jews. Because Christians follow an entirely different lifestyle. From the first century, Christians, even though most of the Christians in the first century were Judeo-Christians, they had been Jewish, but they still, when they became Christian, they, so to speak, eased up. They were not as rigid now in following all the Jewish laws and traditions, because they had a different understanding of the nature of God and what God requires. That's because, you see, in the Old Testament, the time we're looking at, the law was not so rigid. But by New Testament times, the law had become very rigid, very structured. And if you did not obey everything exactly to the letter, you had no chance of getting into what would be called Abraham's bosom, the place of the righteous dead. And so, for the most part, Jews like Peter and Andrew and James and John, they just kind of made their way through life. They tried to be good Jews, but at the same time, they were not always as successful in obeying the law. And, you know, they would hope maybe God would forgive them or something like that. But there was no sense of assurance. I mean, what comes for the believer? Think about John Wesley when he became a Christian. What did he say? He said, "I felt my heart strangely warmed, and I knew in that moment that Christ had forgiven me, even me, and that he had been brought into a new kind of a relationship with God." This is not the system in the Jewish world. In the Jewish world, and it comes from the Old Testament, or an interpretation of the Old Testament. In the Jewish world, the system is law, judgment, death, punishment, and death. And in the New Testament, for the Christian, the law has already been fulfilled, and instead you were brought into the family of God. And an entirely different system is in place for us as believers compared to the system that the Jewish people, since the New Testament period, have understood. In the Jewish world, it is still basically working to achieve righteousness and please God enough that He will let them, so to speak, into heaven. Whereas for the Christian world, the idea is that you, by believing in Jesus Christ, have moved out of the realm of law and judgment and punishment and death and into an entirely different situation. You're part of the family of God. Your eternity doesn't start when you die. Your eternity started when you became a believer in Jesus Christ. And as believers in Jesus Christ, we begin to experience something of heaven now. And that's what you have is a big difference between not Old Testament theology, but the concept of Judaism of beginning in the New Testament period, the concept of Judaism versus what the New Testament teaches for the believer. Now, Old Testament theology, I know I'm kind of backing up a little bit and sort of integrating some things here, but Old Testament theology shows us that to a very large degree, the same basic ideas about God, love, mercy, redemption, forgiveness, grace, are found in the Old Testament. And the people of Israel in, let's say, David's day, or Hezekiah's day, the people of Israel did not see God as this horrible king and judge sitting up here just waiting for them to do something wrong so that he could judge them and punish them and destroy them. That's the concept that the non-Jews or the non-Israelites had about their gods. But the people of the Old Testament loved God. They served Him, some anyway, served Him very willingly. And the law was not necessarily an immense burden on them, but rather something that helped organize and structure their society, and in many cases kept them healthier, kept them actually wealthier than their neighbors. And so for the Jews or the Israelites of the Old Testament, God was a God of mercy and a God of grace and a God of love and a God who was good to them. Now, He could also be a God of justice and a God of wrath and these sorts of things. But they also lived in a different time, in a different world, where people who were in authority very often were, for instance, kings and noblemen, very often were people who were vengeful and wrathful and simply mean in the things that they did. And so even if you take the judgmental aspects of God that you find associated in the Old Testament, culturally, these were not outside the thinking of the Israelite people, because the gods of the other nations were far worse, and even the rulers and the kings and the noblemen and so on in the various nations around them were far worse than the kind of judgments and punishments and so on that were associated with God in the Old Testament. So the people perceived God in a very warm and positive way, generally speaking, and not in a kind of negative way like we tend to do today. So I hope this kind of helps put everything in perspective for you a little bit, that the Old Testament theology helps us understand that the God of the Old Testament really is similar in most ways that you can imagine to the God of the New Testament. It's not two different gods. And to a large extent, it is not two different testaments, but rather one is the story of God and the people of Israel, and how God eventually took one person who was his son, born among the Israelites, to be, in fact, the Messiah and Savior of the world. But in that sense, they can be joined together, but you have to be very careful how you join them together, because otherwise you can make a lot of mistakes in understanding these things. Okay, let's talk briefly about the intent of covenant, because I think it's important to at least touch on these things. The intent of the covenant was to know God. And actually, in some approaches to Old Testament theology, the basic structure that is used is the concept of covenant. And the concept of covenant is to come to know God. In the West, this usually means an abstract knowledge, which is developed through critical analysis. But in the Hebrew world, the world of the Old Testament, coming to know God is a whole, what you could call a holistic and existential knowledge that you gain through living in a relationship with that other person. Or you can say living in close communion with the other one, and not just a conceptual knowledge, an intellectual knowledge, but an actual physical, living, breathing knowledge of the other. So what happens is that the Old Testament is filled with the personal witness of God based on the personal experience that is related in the histories, in the Psalms, in the Proverbs, and in the prophets. It's based on the personal experience of the God that they knew. And out of this comes an understanding of the nature of God and his interaction with the people. And this is the idea then of the covenant, is to allow those who are in the covenant to learn to know God. God created a suzerainty covenant with the Israelites, and in the context of this covenant, he helped them begin to learn to know him as distinct and different and separate from all of the other gods of all of the other peoples. And this was an ongoing process. It was a continuing revelation, beginning from the time that God brought them from Egypt in the Exodus, and continuing all the way through the end of the Old Testament. And, of course, even on into the New Testament time period. Mercy, divine mercy, was one of the big elements to be found in this covenant. And there are two words that you see up on the board, rachamim and chesed, which are associated with this mercy, this divine mercy of God for the people. One is the rachamim is similar to the relationship of a child held near the breast of its mother. And it's the idea of the greatest closeness and tenderness and compassion and yearning of a parent for a child and the child for its mother. And this is one of two words that is associated with the mercy of God. You want to know how he feels about you in the Old Testament period, and you're an Israelite in particular, the word rachamim explains how God feels about you. Chesed is the loving kindness, the mercy, and the compassion which God shows toward those that are his. He is slow to anger. He is long-suffering. He shows pity and things like that. The word chesed occurs 237 times in the Old Testament. Slightly over half of those times is in the book of Psalms. And it is especially used in relation to those who are suffering under oppression, under sin, or its resulting circumstances. And a lot of us really struggle with the situation. If somebody suffers because of sin, there is oftentimes a tendency to say, well, it's their fault. And to say, well, they got what they deserved. But from the Old Testament standpoint, among God's people, God takes pity on them. Even if they are getting what they deserved, God still has mercy and still remains concerned about them. I'll finish with this. In the fall of the year, there was a middle-aged woman that I knew over in China. She's not Chinese, she's a worker from another country in China. And one evening I received a message from a mutual friend telling me that she had been rushed to the hospital with the need for heart surgery. And if you know what stents are, that's where they insert this thing into an artery near the heart, and it opens the artery up so that blood can flow okay. She had two 90% blockages in her heart. And if she did not have the surgery, she would probably be dead by the next day. Now, she does not, or did not then, live a particularly wholesome lifestyle, but she was in a really hurting situation. She needed, let's see, in U.S. dollars, it would be, she needed something like maybe 40,000 or 30,000, I guess 30,000 U.S. dollars to pay for emergency heart surgery. And she had a little bit of money, but almost none. Certainly not the amount of money she needed for the heart surgery, which was why the message went out from this mutual friend to those who knew her, asking if people could help provide some money to pay for the surgery. So what do you do? Do you simply say, well, gee, it's tough, but life is tough. You didn't live a very wholesome life. And I mean, from things she ate and drank and so on, it probably influenced the need for this heart surgery. But do you say, well, it's tough, and if you have heart surgery and you survive, okay, bye-bye, have a good life? Or do you say, yeah, okay, you made a lot of mistakes, but you've got a real problem situation, and I'll help because of this kind of a situation. The notion of chesed is that even if you didn't live the most wholesome lifestyle and you're in a really hurting situation, in a circumstance that results from that, God does not run away from you. God is still there to be with you and go with you through that circumstance. That's chesed. And that's the kind of mercy that the Old Testament talks about, as I said, not one time, not two times, but 287 times in the Old Testament. It talks about this kind of mercy on God's part.